All right, good morning, everyone. I know that I am in a much coveted position of speaking right before lunch. See, I'm the only thing standing between you and the room next door. But I really want to begin, first of all, by thanking the wonderful planning committee. I'm not going to begin to name everyone by name because, thank God, over the years it's expanded. But it's really an incredible privilege to work with such a wonderful group of people, such a cross-section, not just of disciplines, but of backgrounds, of perspectives, of orientations. And it's really beautiful to see a group of people so diverse come together to try to put together a program that hopefully benefits each of us, but each of us in our own particular way. I also really want to thank all the speakers up until now. It's hard to follow Anita's wonderful presentation and the moving simulation. And then even the way we opened up this morning, everything's been wonderful, and it's just a beautiful privilege to be part of such a special program. I want to begin with just a little bit of, I'll call a religious or spiritual framing of the day. You know, in many communities, in many Jewish communities throughout the world, we read the entire Bible, the five books of Moses, the Old Testament, once every year. And amazingly enough, we actually just finished the cycle last week. So interestingly enough, this past week, this past Saturday, this past Shabbos, in many of our synagogues, we read the biblical portion of Genesis. And Genesis happens to be one of my favorite Torah parts. I'm not going to give you a sermon this morning, I promise. But there's so much in there that I think relates to our conversations this morning. So one of the things that always catches my eye is the following. In the first chapter of Genesis, in verse 11, so the Bible states that God created the earth. And along with creating the earth, the dry land, I read it to you. He said, let the earth sprout vegetation, sealed yielding herbs, fruit trees producing fruit according to its kind. So in Hebrew, the verbiage is eitz pri oseh pri, fruit trees that create fruit. And the commentaries explain, why does it have to say fruit trees that create fruit? Just say trees that create fruit. And the rabbis explain in a dramatic way that in the beginning, God's plan was that the fruit would taste like fruit, and amazingly enough, the trees would taste like fruit as well. But yet, when it comes time to actual creation, the Bible says that God created trees that produced fruit. And the rabbis explain, because the earth did not comply. The earth didn't listen. God wanted trees that would taste like fruit, and instead you have trees that taste like trees. Don't try it. Take my word for it. Trees that taste like trees and fruit that tastes like fruit. And the obvious question is, trees don't have free will. Nature doesn't have the ability to make its own cognitive decisions. So obviously the rabbis, the Bible, is trying to teach us something deeper. Whereas there are many different answers that are given, I want to share with you one. It's brought down by one of the great rabbis who lived in the 1700s in Prague, by the name of the Maharal. The Maharal explains that when God wanted to create the earth, what does it mean that he wanted trees that tasted like fruit? The trees should taste like fruit. The fruit tastes like fruit. God wanted to create a world in which there was perfection. The idea is everything is sweet. Everything is beautiful. Everything is magnificent. But when it comes time for actual creation, God teaches us an incredible lesson. There is no perfection in this world. This world is not about perfection. This world is not even about finding perfection. So you ask yourself, well, why can't a perfect God create a perfect world? And to this, the rabbis give a magnificent answer. You see, if God would have created a magnificent world, then what are we here to do? If God were to create a perfect world, then what is our role? Instead, what God does is he created an imperfect world perfectly. God created an imperfect world by design. Why? So that he gives each of us the opportunity to join with him in the creative process. He gives us the opportunity to say, listen, I gave you the foundation. I created a beautiful, magnificent world, but there are many imperfections. There are many faults. There are many shortcomings. But it's not your job to lament. It's not your job to complain. It's not your job to say, oh, woe to us. It's your job to roll up your sleeves and try to figure out how to make it a little bit better, a little bit more beautiful, to infuse a little bit of man-made perfection into a divinely orchestrated, imperfect world. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is because in the third year now of this conference, thank God, We focus on the imperfections. We focused on the realities that many of us must deal with each and every day. Some of us from a background of medicine, others social work, nursing, some of us as clergy, and some of us just as community members who grapple with these issues with our family as well. But understand that these issues offer us a unique opportunity to partner with God and to try to find a little bit more perfection in the imperfect world. We're dealing today with an imperfection. And the imperfection is that some people are born with bodies or with organs that don't fully function. That is a reality. Yet amazingly enough, and it was just dawning on me today, isn't it amazing to think about the idea that God created us, most times, with two kidneys? And isn't it amazing to realize that we could survive with only one? So if I were teaching a class, I would throw out a question. I would say, how much extra stuff did God put into creation? What would you say? Nothing. There's nothing extra in this world. There's nothing extra in this universe. Which means that by definition, everything that's here is here for a purpose. Now, I'm not saying this as a taking a stance on organ donation. We'll get to that in just a little bit. I'm just pointing out that the unique opportunity we have when we grapple with these issues is to try to partner with God in the creative process and try to remedy some of the imperfections that are clear and that are obvious all around us. It's ultimately through confronting and correcting these imperfections that we partner with God in the creative process. So today we're discussing challenges in organ donation and transplantation. And I was asked to speak on spirituality and religion in organ donation and transplantation. So it's a great privilege to be the mouthpiece of God, you know, for the next 25 minutes. But I want to be clear, I don't plan on, there's no way to cover all of the religious views. I mean, even if I'm here just to talk about Judaism, there's no way to speak about all the complex religious stances and opinions. Instead, what I would just like to do is to kind of create a little bit of a panoramic view of the religious and spiritual sensitivities. And my hunch is that many of the major religions share a lot of these same sensitivities. So I'm not here to tell you the definitive stance on Judaism is this, or the definitive spiritual stance is this. That would be exceptionally precocious and arrogant on my part. Instead, I'm just here to kind of set the table before you in terms of some of the religious and spiritual issues. So I'd like to divide my few minutes into two different topics. Let's first speak on the topic of a live donor. Live donor, and simply address the following question. If I'm a match, and we'll just use kidney for just ease's sake. If I'm a match for someone in need of a kidney, from a Jewish perspective, should I, must I, and can I donate? You see, from a Jewish perspective, every single question in life is always analyzed through the prism of religion. There is no separate code of ethics. There is no separate mandate. There is no separate criteria. For a religious Jew, and again, religious, we all define religious however we define it, but often our first stop is, well, what does Judaism say about this? So what does Judaism say? I'm a match, whether it's for a relative or for someone else. So can I, must I, and should I donate? So interestingly enough, the Bible gives us a fascinating mandate. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 15, so the Bible says, "Unishmartem ma'od l'nafshosechem." You have to be exceedingly careful with your health. So for example, if someone were to come to me and ask me, "Rabbi, I have a little bit of time on my hands. I'm thinking about taking up smoking." So I would first give them a list of other things they could occupy their time with. But then I would also, you understand, it is my opinion, it is biblically prohibited to smoke. Why is it biblically prohibited to smoke? Because again, we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that smoking is objectively deleterious to your health. The Torah advises us, now again, this of course is quite an interesting question, because if somebody were to ask me, "Rabbi, I'm thinking about taking up skydiving." So again, that would also be a fascinating question, which again would require some level of just spiritual pondering, religious pondering. So again, it's clear if somebody wanted to take up smoking, we would say from a biblical perspective, it's unequivocally prohibited because you're engaging in something that is actively detrimental to your health. Well, going ahead and becoming an organ donor is also puts oneself in the degree of harm. Now, obviously, the degree of danger to oneself depends on the health of the individual, depends on the particular type of donation, but it is a reality that must be contended with. On the other hand, in Judaism, as I would assume in all of the major religions, chesed, I'm going to try to say as many chuz as possible today, chesed, so kindness is one of our paramount values. One of the things that we pride ourselves as a religion is try to do not just simply good, but try to be kind to the other. And that's Jew and Gentile alike. So if I have the ability to go ahead and do something not just nice, but something potentially life-saving for an individual, well, that becomes a religious mandate as well. So you see now the conflict. On one hand, the Bible enjoins us from going in and doing anything that places ourselves in harm's way. On the other hand, I also have an obligation to help another whenever possible. So how do I reconcile this conflict? My well-being essentially conflicts with the well-being of another. See, interestingly enough, there's a fascinating ethical dilemma that's brought down in the Talmud. And I think it's been co-opted as perhaps becoming the paradigmatic ethical dilemma. And it's brought down, it's in Tractate Bava Metzia, and it deals with the following situation. Two people are traveling together. Ubiyad echad mehen kiton shalmayim. They're traveling in the deserts, and only one of them has a canteen of water. And there's only enough water for one individual. So here are the choices the Talmud lays out. Im shnei shosim shnei, if both drink, mesim, they both die. If one drinks, he has the ability to make it to habitation, he has the ability to go ahead and survive. So what does one do in such a circumstance? You could be benevolent, both could share the water, both die, or one drinks the water and lives. So amazingly enough, this is a dispute within the Talmud. The first opinion, which is brought down by Ben Petura, says something amazing. He says, they both have to drink. You have to share. So let's assume I'm the one holding the water. I have to share the water with my friend. Why do I have to share the water? What good does that do? We both die. To which Ben Petura responds, Al yira echad neheb misaso shal chavero. How could I see someone else die? How could it be that I'm going to survive at someone else's expense? Granted, it's my canteen. It's my water. Remember, again, Jewish law does not allow you to grab the canteen from someone else to drink it. But assuming it's my canteen. But Ben Petura says, from a moral, ethical, human perspective, how could I go on living knowing that when I drank the water, good, I go on, but my act resulted directly in someone else's death? But the great sage Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, no, that indeed is not the law. My life comes before someone else's life. Meaning as important as it is to be there for another, as important as it is to take care of another, ultimately, again, I have the right to preserve my life before I go ahead and actively preserve another. And therefore, again, Rabbi Akiva says, if you are holding on to the water, you have every right to drink it yourself. It's true. Who could imagine the guilt that such an individual have to live with for the rest of their life, knowing that their act of survival resulted in someone else's death? But at the end of the day, Rabbi Akiva says, that is the imperative. Chayecha kol min, my life comes before someone else's life. So you understand, of course, why the entire discussion of organ donation is incredibly complex within Judaism. Because we have these competing values. On one hand, again, I have to be a bal chesed, I have to be a charitable, kind individual. And it doesn't just mean to smile for people, it means to go out of my way for people. It means to help people. But at the same time, Jewish law mandates that I have to focus on sustaining my own life before sustaining the lives of others. So the Jewish opinions throughout the ages have dealt with this in different ways. And contemporarily, the general consensus I'm really just focusing within the spectrum of Orthodox Jewry, because again, even within Judaism, we have many different streams, and those streams definitely deal with these issues differently. I'm only really representing a consensus opinion of one particular stream, is that the obligation to donate really depends on the level of risk involved for the donor. So let me just share with you two ideas. If the danger to the donor
is much less than the danger to the recipient, meaning that danger to the donor is much less than the danger to the recipient if he or she does not receive the organ, then the donor is permitted to donate, but not required. So there's permission to donate. As long as the recipient has greater risk than I, the donor, then I am permitted from a Jewish law perspective to do so, but not required. And the reason, and this goes back to something Anita just mentioned as well, the same way that that we would want to give the donor the opportunity to decline the donation for whatever reason, without having to tell the particular recipient that your son didn't want to donate to you, Judaism also understands you can't demand of a person to give up a part of their body for another. Even if their risk is lower than the potential recipient, there's a limit to what you could demand of people. So again, as long as the danger to the donor is much less than the danger to the recipient, Judaism allows for donation, but is not required. But here's the interesting part. If the risk to the donor is minimal, now obviously these terms need to be quantified, but if the risk to the donor is minimal, then there would be an obligation to donate. So I think maybe the best example of this would be bone marrow. So for example, if I'm a marrow match to someone else, where the risk to the donor is really minimal, if I am a match for someone, Jewish law would say I have an obligation to go ahead and donate that marrow to another individual. So that's when it comes to, and again, I want to be clear, I'm only putting the issues out there, by no means doing justice to the entire issue, just trying to kind of frame it a little bit. That's the realm of live donors. What about cadaveric donors? So here we have another interesting idea, and actually this takes us back a little bit to something we had discussed in our first seminar, in our first conference, where we spoke about, you know, end-of-life issues. There's a concept, in Judaism, as I'm sure again in other religions, we believe that the body is sacred. The body is a receptacle ultimately for the soul, and even once the soul has left the body, which is what we believe death is the departure of the soul from the body still retains its sanctity. That's how we have a prohibition of what we call nivul hames, desecrating the dead. So this manifests itself in many different ways. So in many streams of Judaism, we do not allow cremation because we feel that cremation is a desecration of the body. We won't allow autopsies. Leaving aside specific situation where there's an acute need for that, we will not allow for tampering with the body after death. That's why, according to Jewish tradition, we also bury as quickly as possible. We try not to delay between death and burial, again, as a sign of respect. So on one hand, one would think that cadaveric donations, taking organs from a body, from a dead body, would go ahead and potentially constitute some type of desecration of the dead. So that's one possibility, although the way to address that is, according to many opinions, desecration of a corpse only applies to things that are objectively observable. So if you were to take a limb from a corpse, that would be a desecration of the body. But to take something internal that perhaps could not be observed by someone looking at the body would not constitute a type of desecration of the body. But there's another piece that in Judaism we believe that, I think as Dr. Perman began with the quote of the Talmud, that kol ha'makayim nefesh achas, whoever sustains one life, it's as if he or she has sustained an entire world. We believe that nothing overrides the saving of a life. Meaning, at the end of the day, life is paramount. That's why, for example, the Torah, the Bible, gives us, and together the Bible and we have 613 commandments. We take those commandments exceptionally seriously. But if I have to transgress one of those commandments in order to save my life, I am absolutely permitted to do so, with three exceptions. We can't worship idolatry, we can't engage in sexual immorality, and I can't commit an act of murder. So if saving my life requires transgression of any one of those three things, that I can't do. But aside from that, anything and everything is permitted for the preservation of life. So again, you see the tension. On one hand, the body is sacred, and one of the ways in which we express the sacredness of the body is by keeping it intact, not touching it, not doing anything. There are even limitations as to who handles the body after a person passes. I have the sanctity of the body. On the other hand, if when a person dies, they actively have the ability to go ahead and preserve, or I should say give life to another, it would seem that that would trump any other consideration. So I'll quote to you, there's a well-known Jewish ethicist by the name of Dr. Fred Rosner. So Dr. Rosner was the director of the Department of Medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. I don't think it's called Mount Sinai, I think it's called something else now. See, he's perhaps one of the most prolific writers when it comes to Jewish ethics, medical ethics. And I want to quote to you his paragraph, a few lines from him. Not everyone agrees with it, but I think it's very telling. He says, "The attitude of Judaism toward organ transplantation has always been a positive one. Based on the concept of saving lives, that is, the lives of recipients dying of organ failure. Thus, heart, lung, kidney, liver, and other life-saving organ transplantation is not only permitted in Judaism, but mandated, based on the supreme value of human life. All legal considerations and prohibitions are set aside for the overriding goal of saving life of the recipient. These legal concerns, especially regarding the donor, include the possible desecration of the donor, deriving benefit from the donor, delaying the burial of the donor, and obtaining permission or consent from the donor and or the donor's family." Now, Dr. Rosner writes this as quite authoritative, although I'll tell you, there are many others who disagree with this. As someone, one of the previous, I think it was Rabbi Ruth, had mentioned, we have no one opinion in Judaism. There is no one spokesman. There is no one opinion. There's a multiplicity. There is a spectrum of opinions. Dr. Rosner happens to represent one group, but there are others who vociferously disagree. But here we come to what the real issue is. Because even assuming that organ transplantation, cadaveric transplantation, is permitted according to Jewish law, we get into another very touchy situation, which is the definition of death. And I want to spend a few moments on this because something came up during the simulation that I thought was exceptionally interesting. So we know again that even though since 1968 the Harvard criteria has been accepted, you know, we've been a people that have been around for a few thousand years. And so 1968 is like yesterday for us. So it's nice the world got on board with the Harvard criteria. But again, first of all, as Anita mentioned, there is definitely a movement to re-examine it. And there was much criticism of the development and creation of the Harvard criteria, some of which was leveled because some felt that it was a mechanism to allow for greater harvesting of organs. So I'm not here to talk about the Harvard criteria. All I'm here to talk about is the following, that there are different definitions. I am a religious Jew. I'm an educated person. I went to college, graduate school. I hold a few different degrees. I get to speak at medical ethics conferences. I subscribe to a cardiac view of death. That is my personal opinion. I'm not here representing Judaism. That is not based because I deny the authenticity of medicine. And that is not because I choose to bury my hand because of scientific developments. Those are my religious views. And for me, as well as for many others, they are as real as any scientific evidence that any doctor, physician, or scientist is going to furnish. And I share this to you because of the following idea. During the simulation, when Dr. Hollander in the back raised the question about what if a family subscribes to a brain death criteria, and I think a number of the responses kind of focused on the same idea that we'll work with the family to get them on board with the brain death criteria. I would humbly disagree with that approach. And I would say that no hospital should ever try to convince anyone of what their beliefs should be. A hospital has every right to say, we conduct ourselves according to certain criteria, we can service you up until this point. This is what we could do for you. And if you can't do any more, if you don't want that, we're happy to help you with other possibilities. But it is exceptionally important. I just want to take one step back. The whole point of this conference, this ongoing series, is to foster a mutual respect and understanding for the multiplicity of opinions and feelings that exist. And when someone comes in with religious sensitivities, those religious sensitivities are as real as any scientific data that anyone else could furnish. I am not the caveman because I believe a cardiac death is the definition of death. My views and my feelings are informed because of my religious sensitivities. So I think it's important that we recognize that, again, they're all right. It's not our place to judge who's right, who's wrong. They're all correct. We are here because the best way that we could go ahead and most effectively treat our patients and our families is to foster an atmosphere and a framework of collaborative, synergistic partnership. And that only comes about if we take the time to truly understand the position, the vantage point, and the beliefs of others. So when it comes to discussions about cadaveric donation, so understand, depending on the views of the particular Jewish family you're speaking to, a lot of it will come down to how they understand or how they view the actual time of death. Obviously, if someone subscribes to the brainstem death, that obviously widens the possibility for which organs can be taken versus cardiac death. But again, I'm telling you my own personal opinion. I'm not here to tell you the opinions of Judaism because there is no one opinion in Judaism. But at least hopefully been able to give you a little bit of just a broad-based view of the issues concerning live donors, the issues concerning cadaveric donors. And I just want to end off with one last piece, because something else struck me. As I mentioned before, we were able to read the Torah portion of Genesis. And one of the most exciting things that happens in Genesis is the creation of man. And the Bible relates the following. It says, "Vayapel Hashem Elokim tardema ala Adam." Adam was created, God put him to sleep. And what did God do? Vayikach achas mitzalosav. He took one of his ribs. Interestingly enough, one could posit that Eve was created through a rib donation. The first ever organ donation happens within the opening chapters of Genesis. And so I often wonder to myself, on a serious note, why did God create the first human beings like that? I mean, he created Adam. Why not just create Adam and Eve? Why does the second human being have to come from a piece of the body, from the side, literally, of Adam? And I think that God is teaching us a very important message. We will continue to have differing opinions in many areas as to how to care for the sick. But the message that God is giving us, I think, is clear, which is that we must always take of ourselves in order to be able to give to the other. Whether it's a kidney, or whether it's a heart, or whether it's love, compassion, and empathy, we must strive to become the kind of people who transcend ourselves and live lives in which we are there for the other. It's truly inspiring to be in a room filled with people, professionals, community members, clergy, who are all here for one reason: to strive to become better caregivers, to strive to figure out how we can take a little bit of ourselves and be able to give that to those around us who are in need, to those around us who are struggling, to those around us who are having a difficult time. Let us hope that in the merit of coming together for this special program, discussing the process of one human being giving to another, that we emerge revitalized to give, to do, and to support one another. Thank you.
Although we're right at where we're supposed to wait for lunch, we did allow an hour.